You're listening to the Gleneagle INEC Arena podcast. Keep up to date with all our events by following us on Facebook or visiting inec.ie. As one of the world's leading TV hypnotists, mentalists, and brain hackers, Keith Barry has been blazing a trail across the globe for many years. His mind-blowing skills have been showcased in over 40 international TV shows, including his most recent series, You're Back in the Room. Now, as well as his own hugely successful US TV series, Keith has appeared many times on some of the biggest TV shows in America, such as The Ellen DeGeneres Show, Jimmy Kimmel, and The Conan O'Brien Show. Now, no stranger to Killarney, having played in the INEC many times over the last 20 years, Keith and I sat down for a chat and we began by talking about the moment he realised magic was a thing he wanted to do for the rest of his life.
Well, look, I got a Paul Daniels magic set. You're probably too young even now to remember Paul Daniels. But Paul Daniels was the foremost magician when I was young. So he was British and he had a TV series on BBC.
Right.
So anybody over the age of, I'm going to say 35, would probably know who Paul Daniels was.
Yeah.
He had the longest TV series in history, still to this date, magic series.
Okay.
So I got a magic set of his when I was five. So that got my interest going. And then every year I would get a magic set at Christmas.
Yeah.
But then when I was 14, I got a book on magic called The Klutz Book of Magic. And I got that on a school tour in Scotland. And that was a really good book.
Yeah.
And I started to perform in the public eye when I was 14. So that's when I kind of really, got the goo for it, you know.
And it was just in your hometown you started performing? Or did you start travelling around?
No, so when I was 14, I started performing out and about. So kids' parties. My mum and dad used to drive me everywhere to all the different gigs. Yeah. So I used to do kids' parties. I did close-up magic in a restaurant in Waterford called the Wine Vault. And then when I was 15, kind of 16, I started in the boats from Rosslare to Cherbourg and Roscoff as the kids' magician on the ferry.
Yeah.
And I was only a kid myself. But it was an amazing experience. Good learning curve as well, you know, to do all different branches of magic, you know.
And I can imagine, like, you kind of, through that, like, you made contacts with people that would have got you further up along the line.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose. So I'm from Waterford, and you know, so I got quite well known in Waterford, but that was really it. And then my parents were like, you know, this is all great, but you're going to college.
Yeah,
magic is great as a hobby. So I went to Galway, UCG it was known as then, NUIG now, and I studied chemistry. So I graduated with an honours chemistry degree. I'm actually a cosmetic scientist by trade, which means I used to invent women's makeup. And so I was doing that. So when I left Galway, I moved to Dublin. And this, to loop back to what you said, it was really in Dublin where I started to get to know a lot of people in the industry.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I started doing magic in U2's nightclub at the time. So that was called The Kitchen.
Oh,
so
yeah,
The Kitchen
was
the place in Dublin.
What's
at the time.
What's the name of it now?
The Liquor Rooms.
Liquor Rooms, yeah.
Yeah. So I started doing the magic in the VIP area in the kitchen.
Yeah.
So that's where I got to meet all these different celebrities and I started kind of getting the title, Magician to the Stars, that kind of stuff. But that's where I got all the different contacts. Like, I met Pat Kenny in there one night randomly and that's how I ended up in the Late Late Show.
Is it?
Yeah. So my first performance of the Late Late Show came from meeting him in there and then it kind of snowballed on from there, you know?
Yeah. Did you move to Dublin full time to pursue magic, or was it just something you always wanted to do? But did you just want to be based there? What brought you to Dublin?
I think I got lucky that I ended up in Dublin, because if I didn't land in Dublin, I probably would have had a different career path than I've had. Insofar as when I left college, I did what everybody did back then, at least, which was just apply for a bunch of jobs everywhere. In the industry that I was, you know, qualified for.
Yeah.
And I just got lucky that the job that I got was based in Sandyford in Dublin, which was for Oriflame, which is a Swedish cosmetics company. But their R&D department is in Dublin. And it's now in Wicklow. But ultimately, that's how I ended up in Dublin. So it was just kind of pot luck that I got. If I got a job in, you know, Merck Sharp and Dome, my life could have been far different.
I
wouldn't have ended up in Dublin. I probably wouldn't have had the opportunities that I've had in Dublin to kind of, you know, excel in my career, you know.
What brought you to cosmetics? What was it?
Oh, it didn't matter to me. Like, at that stage, I did want to be an entertainer, magician full time, but I needed an income. So I just applied for all different jobs that I was qualified. Yeah. So I was qualified, like, you know, to work in pharmaceuticals. I was qualified to work in the cosmetics industry. So I just applied for all kinds of different jobs. And then I figured out after 2.5 years that it wasn't going to be something that I was going to be staying with. And then magic, after 2.5 years of being a full-time cosmetic scientist, my magic career was starting to take over at that stage. I was getting so busy, my day job was kind of getting in the way, you know.
What was the moments you kind of you realized, you know, that you were actually, you know, becoming quite well known for magic in Ireland? Like, what was the turning point? You went from, you know, moving to Dublin, and was it going on the Late Late Show with Pat Kenny?
No, I think there's this thing about it all started on the Late Late Show, and obviously the Late Late Show helps a lot. But I remember actually being slightly disappointed after my first Late Late Show appearance, because, you know, as a young performer, it being not my first time on TV, because I'd done a couple of talent shows and stuff on TV, but certainly the biggest thing that I'd ever done on TV, I actually thought, you know, in the naivety of a young person's mind, me being in my early 20s at the time, I thought, this is it. You know, I'm on the Late Late Show, I'm going to be famous, everybody's going to know me. And then I remember the next day just walking down the streets and just waiting for somebody to look at me and, you know, ask me, and nobody asked, are you the magician of the Late Late Show? So then I realized, okay, it helps, but it's just a small part of the puzzle. So really, I suppose where I started to gain recognition was off the back of my first TV series on RTE. And that was 2003, and that was Close Encounters with Keith Barry. So that was 10 half hours. It was every Sunday night. And then I did a second season of that as well. So that was the moment, I suppose, really, when it allowed me to start touring, for example, and come to places like this, you know.
How did that first TV show come about?
So, you know, obviously, in the entertainment industry, you need television. Certainly need exposure. If not television these days, you have to have stuff on the internet and so on. So for me, you know, getting a TV show was key. So I hooked up with a TV producer at the time, Billy McGrath. And we literally just grabbed two cameramen and one sound guy. We went down to Henry Street. I remember it very well. I went down to Henry Street and just filmed a bunch of stuff in Henry Street. And then he cut it together. And we walked into RTE, into the execs in there, and said, look, this is the type of magic that I do. This is what I'd love to do. So we showed them the tape. Then I performed for them as well. And that was it.
And they loved it.
Yeah, got the first series, you know.
And when with the magic tricks, like, were they ones that you've seen, let's say, when you were a kid, you like learning magic, were they ones you've taken from, or did you actually kind of, you know, put your own edge on things? Did you make up your own tricks? Like,
yeah, no, so magic is much like the guitar, really.
Yeah.
Once you learn enough about the guitar, you learn to make your own music.
Yeah.
Same with magic. So by the time I was in my early 20s, 23, when I, you know, when I started to perform on television, I guess, or 23, 24, for me, you know, it was important that I started to invent my own tricks. So, you know, I've been at this since I'm five. By that stage, I was already developing new tricks. Like, my girlfriend at the time, who's my wife now, she was studying psychology in college while I was studying chemistry, and I started to read all her psychology books. So that's when I started to mix psychology in with magic.
Okay.
So right from the get-go, from Close Encounters with Keith Barry, I developed all my own material. Which was great, because, you know, then people can't expose it because they don't know how you're doing it.
So after the first season of your TV show at RT, when did things start going up, let's say, in America? Because I know you were on, like, the Ellen Show. You were on, was it Letterman you were on?
No, I've been on Conan and Ellen, a whole bunch of Jimmy Kimmel.
Yeah, that must be surreal, coming from, you know, 5 years old, you know, in Waterford learning magic, to going over to America and being on, like, one of the biggest shows over there. Like, what were you feeling, like, even traveling to America to do those shows? Like,
it was amazing, you know. I suppose what people don't know is the graft that goes in before all of that. So, you know, I started traveling to the States again in my early 20s and went into a lot of debt while I was over there, because, you know, you're going over, you're not working, you don't have a visa, and literally just trying to make it happen. So at that time, I was spending a lot of time in nightclubs, infiltrating the VIP sections of nightclubs and performing for all these different celebrities.
Yeah.
So Justin Timberlake and, you know, Eve, the rapper, and Paris Hilton at the time, Jack Osborne. So I got to know all of those people. And then I was in a nightclub one time, and I was performing. It was for Paris Hilton. It was actually Jack Osborne, Guy Rosenberg, who was Eve's manager, and one other celebrity, I can't even remember now, but I was performing for that, and they were screaming and just really reacting well to the magic. And this lady got up, Heather Parry is her name, so she was an exec for MTV, and she said, I've just been watching you from the other corner of the room. Do you want your own TV show? And I said, I'd love it. She said, well, we're filming Spring Break next week in Cancun in Mexico. I'm going to give you your own show. So the next week, I was in Cancun in Mexico filming my own TV show for MTV.
Yeah.
So that was the first TV that I did in the States. And then it snowballed on from there. And then I ended up on Ellen, and I've done Ellen 5 times, I think it is now. So yeah, you know, I don't take any of it for granted even now. You know, my latest TV show just aired over in the States on the CW network called Hypnotize Me. So that was a spin-off of Your Back in the Room that I did for ITV. But even now, I mean, look, I do realize that there's millions of magicians trying to you know, do the same thing. But yeah, I'm very fortunate that, you know, it's worked out for me. And and I do pinch myself when I look back in the days that I used to do the magic in like the Kitchen Nightclub or in Waterford in the wine vault. And it's great, you know.
But I think, do you know what the difference is? Because you do see a lot of magicians, you know, going around the place. You've the passion in it when you talk, you know, and I think that's what kind of that what grabs people, like, not just obviously at home, like, but around the place, because if they believe you, like, you know, in your, when you speak, like, you're that passionate about what you do that, you know, they want to be involved, like, and I think that makes a huge difference, like, you know, for people, like, because you could say, like, did you get lucky going over and meeting, just bumping into these execs, or was it something that was you were always meant to do? Do you know?
Well, I have an answer for that, because I remember a large part of my inspiration actually came from just one moment and one quote. I remember Will Smith being interviewed years ago, now a long time, decades ago. And it was the time when he was just, he was really only a rapper. He wasn't really acting that much at the time.
Yeah.
He was mainly known for his rapping. And I remember the question to put to him was, you know, why are you so successful and other rappers aren't? And his answer was really intriguing. He said, when all the other rappers are in bed sleeping, I'm up practicing my rapping.
Yeah.
And that stays true for me even to this day. Like, my average sleep pattern, and I don't recommend this, by the way, but it's just the way I work, is 4 hours a night. And I work pretty much the other 20 hours. Now, when I say work the other 20 hours, I take time for family and I take time for my kids.
Yeah.
But that aside, you know, I work 18 to 20 hours a day.
So what time did you get up?
Well, this morning I got up at 8, okay, but I was up till 3 working. So I got five hours sleep last night. And then I, you know, I came down here, and then I'm going from here to Radio Kerry, and Radio Kerry I drive back up. So in the car alone, it'll be 8 hours. But even when I'm in the car, I'm on the hands-free and I'm getting calls and stuff. But then ultimately, you have to outwork everybody. It's a real rat race that I'm in. You know, there's younger guys on YouTube and on Instagram that I'm battling with for ticket sales. So for me, it is that work ethic is a huge part of it. And then you have to position yourself to be in places where luck will happen. I mean, if you're sitting at home practicing The Secret and attracting, you know, your career, it's just not going to happen for you.
Do you believe in that book?
I don't believe in the way it's presented. I believe in the ethos of it. So I believe you have to have a positive mindset. I believe you have to set goals. You shouldn't limit yourself at all with those goals. But then ultimately, you know, those things aren't going to land in your lap. You have to clearly have those goals on a subconscious level and visualize them. But then you got to outwork everybody. Now, you know, the experts, and actually, look, as a hypnotherapist, I do a lot of mind coaching. So I, when I'm working with somebody like, for example, Rory Best, I'll tell Rory he's got to sleep 7 hours a night. And I know the science behind it as a scientist. Mm-hmm. It's not 6 hours, it's not 8 hours. It's actually 7 hours is the optimum level of sleep. Now, if you get more than that, it's good too. But so, for example, an athlete is about 20% more prone to injury if they don't get that 7 hours of sleep. So 7 hours is kind of optimum for your mindset. But there comes a point when, you know, if I'm putting a tour together and it's 3 weeks out and the tour is not fully ready, I got to crunch the hours. It's got to happen. Because I have so many projects on the go all the time, it's regularly 18 to 20 hour days. But I don't mind that because I love what I do.
Yeah, so you don't feel like you're ever wearing yourself out working too hard?
Yeah, well, I used to get sick every Christmas and spend every Christmas in bed. So there is that gamble. So yeah, I'll end up crashing and burning for about a week every year. So you do have burnout. But if you look at any of the the performers, if you look at the Netflix documentaries that are out there on performers like Lady Gaga, like she's in bits all the time. But it's because we have that work ethic. Yeah. She works 20 hours a day. The result is, yeah, you end up getting sick and you end up... but, you know, that's part of what we do. If you, you know, if you're not cut out for this industry, do something else.
Yeah.
You know? But I know all the performers. Like, you see, like, if you just type into YouTube, I laugh about it now. Actually, sitting here, I laugh about it specifically. Like, if you type into YouTube, like, just, you know, celebrities getting sick on stage.
Yeah.
You see them all actually just... getting sick on stage.
Yeah.
And then one time I was down here and I was just vomiting on the stage while I was performing. I was hiding behind a big chair that was in the middle of the stage, so nobody really knew I was going to vomit.
Yeah, yeah.
But like, I had full-blown food poisoning one time at the Olympia Theatre, and that was crazy. I ended up collapsing after that gig, up in the dressing room, and had to get a shock doc, as they're called. So they called one of the doctors from a festival that was happening. He had to come in and give me 2 injections just to get me out of the dressing room.
Yeah.
So it's not for the faint of heart, this lifestyle, you know?
And what's the worst, what's the worst thing that's happened to you? Would that be the worst thing that's happened to you on stage?
No. I mean, the worst thing that's happened was actually, I used to do this effect where it was in my 8 Deadly Sins show, where I would get 2 random people up from the audience, give them 100 foot of rope, and they got to tie me to a wooden chair any way they wanted, as tightly as they wanted.
Yeah.
And the whole idea was I had to get out of the rope in less time than they tied me up in. And they would also wrap my head in cling film so I couldn't see or breathe.
Right.
And that was the sin of greed, because I would give them whatever, 500, 1,000 euros each if I couldn't get out in less time than they tied me up in. And then this one night... there was 2 guys on stage, and one of them, it turns out, was an amateur sailor, so he knew all kinds of sailing knots.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
So I knew that was going to be problematic. And then I kicked back in the chair and I slapped off the ground and I winded myself and I went to breathe in, and I breathed in a load of cling film and I just passed out. So I was passed out in front of 1,200 people in the Olympia, and that was that. The curtains came down and that was the end of the show. But that's why you always put an escape at the end of the show, because
there's
always that risk. So that was kind of the most embarrassing thing that's ever happened, I think. You know, it's up on, you can find grainy footage of it up on YouTube. Keith Barry escape gone wrong.
Yeah, it's up there. Did they know you were passed out, or did they think it was part of the
show? Everyone thinks it's part of the show. It's hilarious. Like, everybody, even now, people go, oh, I bet you it was just a publicity stunt. People don't realize. I had 2 more gigs on that tour and they're both sold out, so I didn't need a publicity stunt.
Yeah.
So, no, it just went wrong. I passed out, and like that. Everybody's so shocked. I think they just thought it was part of the show and the curtain came down.
Yeah.
And I think they were waiting for an announcement or something, but nothing happened. They just all slowly trickled out of the theater, you know?
And was it like your manager side stage or someone that was like, no,
yeah,
this has gone wrong?
Yeah, the promoter, Noel, flew up, Noel McHale, and then, you know, my assistant, Evagrius Ponticus at the time, he jumped down off a balcony at the Olympia Hotel.
Right,
and stuff.
Yeah.
So, that's it. Everybody kind of figured out what was happening then, you know?
You were talking about your wife earlier on and your kids. Like, when I was hypnotized by you, that was at least 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Were your kids born back then?
My daughter's 11 and he'll be turning 8 this year.
Okay,
so,
cool, yeah, yeah.
So she was probably just about born at that stage.
How do your kids feel, like, in school, like, when their dad is Keith Barry?
I don't know, it's weird. I've asked them this question and there's no real answer to it. They're just like, whatever, Dad. It's just like, I mean, they don't really pay too much attention to the mad stuff anymore.
Yeah.
I think they find it humorous. I think they find it kind of interesting for themselves when I say, okay, today I want you to wrap my head in cling film, or tomorrow I want you to electrocute me in the head with a cattle prod, or whatever. They just laugh at it. And my wife is just like, I don't want to know. That's her new line.
Yeah,
I was like, I just don't want to know, Keith. Don't ask me to electrocute you, don't, you know, it's just, I'm putting the dinner on, just whatever.
And do you think that's because she just doesn't want to know if you're going to kill yourself today, or if it's...
Yeah, because I go through a lot of testing as well that people don't see, I suppose.
Yeah.
And a lot of that testing involves me doing a lot of stupid things. So, she just doesn't want to know what stupid things I'm doing day to day, I suppose, you know?
Yeah, I remember when I was younger, I can't remember what was the name of the show you were doing, but you were in... Oh, was it the Royal Hospital Kilmainham, maybe?
Could have been, yeah.
And you had somebody shoot you, like, with a gun.
Oh,
but
you
caught the bullet in your teeth, like.
Yeah, the bullet catch.
Yeah. Like, where did that idea come from? Did you not think you were going to...
So that's a very historical piece.
Yeah, yeah.
The bullet catch. And it's interesting you mention it. So there's a book that's been written called 12 Have Died. But actually, a lot more magicians than 12 have died doing the bullet catch.
Yeah.
So it's known as the kind of the black trick of magic. And everybody says, don't do it, because there's been so many accidents.
You're
bound to be jinxed. And I remember contacting the guy who wrote that book, 12 Have Died, just asking him advice on, you know, things to look out for, whatever. And his email back was very interesting. It was just like, just don't do it.
Right.
And that was it. So, of course, I went ahead and did it. But actually, I don't want to say too much, but on that day, there was something that happened before I actually performed it that could potentially have proved fatal on that day. For real, like.
Right.
So even if you look in history, like, you know, Brandon Lee, like Bruce Lee's son, he died from what was just supposed to be a movie gun. And movie guns are literally just guns that are decommissioned and designed just to fire blank bullets. But whatever, a piece of dirt or whatever came out and killed Brandon Lee. So, you know, it's not a good thing to have a gun pointed at your face.
No.
But look, I was young and ambitious at the time, so I loved the idea of doing it. Would I do it again? Probably. But, you know, I've done it now, so I don't see any reason to do it again, you know?
Yeah, because magic is one thing, but going to the very edge, like where you could possibly die, like, I mean, is a completely different thing. Because you see the likes of even David Blaine and, you know, I'm only thinking here, Darren Brown. Mm. Like, you see TV shows they've done where they've literally come to the edge, just like yourself, like, and you're wondering, like, is it real? Or, like, is it, like, what is it that makes us feel like it's...
Well, it depends. I mean, look, there's a lot of different demonstrations. Some of them are real, some of them are a mixture of reality and illusion, and some of them are just an illusion. But, like, you know, for example, on my on one of my TV shows years ago, I got buried in a ton of ice for 47 minutes. And that was kind of the whole demonstration was based around pushing myself to the extremes of, you know, perhaps inducing a near-death experience and stuff. But ultimately, I got really sick after that.
Yeah.
Because
I
was really in a ton of ice for 47 minutes. There was no trick. You know, and when you do, like, for example, a straitjacket escape is what it says on the tin. It's an escape where you've got to escape from restraints which are designed to ultimately hold people in and not allow you to escape.
Yeah.
And you have to train for those things. And my twist is wrapping my head in cling film, or getting my head wrapped in cling film, which was on, like, my TV series, The Keith Barry Experience on RTE.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was up 150 foot in the air. Look, if the crane jams, and if I can't get out of the straitjacket, I'm sure people don't really think about this stuff. I do.
Yeah.
Like, if the crane jams and I'm upside down in a straitjacket and I can't get out, that's it. It's curtains.
Yeah.
Like, if the cranes drop loads all the time, so if the crane drops me or comes down at speed and slaps me against the ground, I'm dead.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? There's all these things that you have to get over and go through and whatever. So, like, those particular demonstrations, in essence, are real. Like David Blaine, when he's on tour, I saw him here, like, I know him quite well, but he was on tour here. Amazing show. It was really good. He did the Borgosh Energy Theatre.
Yeah.
And he held his breath for about 10 minutes that night underwater. And he really held his breath underwater for 10 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, so.
So he's just that talented at not just magic, but obviously, you know, physical.
Yeah, like on one of my tours, I was doing an escape underwater, and every night I was holding my breath for anywhere between 3 and 4.5 minutes.
Yeah.
You know, David, when he does it, he uses what's called oxygen assist. So he's breathing pure oxygen for about 15 minutes before he does it.
Okay,
super oxygenate your bloodstream. That's how you can do an extended breath hold. Mm-hmm. So, but for me, I wasn't using any oxygen assist, and I was doing an escape at the same time. But again, I trained myself to do that. I used the Wim Hof breathing technique, and I use divers breathing techniques to train my lung capacity and stuff. But I'm riddled with injuries from all this stuff. That's the bigger problem, I suppose, is just managing all the different injuries.
But you have to train hard, like, before you do things like that. Like, you have to obviously stay quite fit.
Yeah. And my problem is now that I'm so injured, I'm probably not as fit as I should be. You know, I ripped my muscle. The latest injury that I have is I ripped my muscles off my rib cage about a year ago. And it's even now I'm still in physio in the sports surgery clinic up in Dublin. So it's going to take me a while to get back to any level of fitness, because I got to do just exactly what they're telling me to do to get my rib cage better. But look, I've got impingements. So I bore you to death with it. I have impingements under my shoulders. I have a 7-inch plate in that leg, 13 screws in my ankle, a degenerative disc in my back.
Jesus.
So yeah, pretty beat up.
You shouldn't be trying to kill yourself and all your illusions and tricks out, like, because you could probably die, like, you know.
Yeah, like, but, like, you know, it's part of what we do. So you just don't, it's like a rugby player. You don't moan about it because it's part of your job, you know.
Yeah, you're doing it for the fans, man. Well, I hope you stay alive anyway for as long as possible.
Ah, yeah.
Tell me about your live shows. What's the name of your latest one?
Insanity. So yeah. I'm really excited about Insanity. Of course, we're here on January 18th. And, you know, it is my most insane show to date. Like, it truly is. So in the first half, I examine, you know, characters from history that were either insane or geniuses, because there's that blurred line between insanity and genius. So I examine Edward Munch. So Edward Munch most famously painted the Scream painting. And, you know, it turns out at the time he was going in and out of mental institutions for bouts of insanity.
Yeah.
And he was getting electroshock therapy. And then I realized electroshock therapy, when I did my research on it, it ignites your right hemisphere, which is where your creativity lies.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's how he came up with those paintings. So every night on tour, I get electrocuted into my temples while somebody's thinking of something, and I got to figure out what they're thinking of while they're electrocuting me at the same time. And then Rasputin the Mad Monk, I've got demonstrations based around him, and the whole idea around him was he apparently had kind of superhuman abilities. Even when he was dying, I mean, they tried to assassinate him, so they gave him cyanide that would have killed 10 men.
Yeah.
He survived that, so then they shot him. He survived that. He got out of the building. Then they shot him another 8 times. He survived that. Then they threw him into the river. He survived that. And then they eventually found him dead on the banks of the river. He managed to get out, though. So he had these superhuman abilities. So every night I'd take somebody up on stage and I'd give them superhuman abilities. So I give them super strength and all this kind of crazy stuff.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I also talk about Elon Musk and artificial intelligence.
Yeah.
And have this whole routine that I've based around artificial insanity, as I call it, because he's got a company called Neuralink. And the whole idea about Neuralink, it's all about mind-to-mind communication. And so I teach people how to have the ability of mind-to-mind communication on stage. So all these kind of weird, quirky demonstrations. And then we get into the kind of edgier stuff where, you know, talk about lobotomies. So lobotomies, where they used to take ice picks and drive them over people's eyeballs into the brain to separate the left and right hemisphere. So I get somebody up on stage and I perform a Russian roulette with a spike and my eyeballs,
right?
Based around lobotomies. And then in the second half, I turn the tide on the audience. So the first half, I talk about these characters, but then the characters in the second half are actually the audience themselves.
Okay.
And I tell everybody to think of insane thoughts that they couldn't possibly know about them.
Yeah.
And then I've got to try and figure out their insane, mad mental thoughts. Huge amount of audience interaction there. But I know what some of your viewers would be thinking. Well, that's great, but I'm not going to go for fear of landing on stage or being embarrassed.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So to get around that, we're going to leave 500 meters of tinfoil outside the front door of the INEC arena. So if you get there early, all you need to do is make a tinfoil hat. And if you make a tinfoil hat and you wear your tinfoil hat, you have my word that you're safe in the audience. If you don't wear a tinfoil hat, free game.
Okay, yeah.
If you want to come a bit later, just make your tinfoil hat at home and bring it along.
So if you wear the tinfoil hat, you don't have to go up on stage?
Exactly.
Okay.
And even if something's happening where people in the audience are participating, you can kick back and relax. I won't go near you if you wear your tinfoil hat. So a lot of fun, crazy, insane. There's a routine in there where, you know, we're heading towards 1,500 people coming to the INEC.
Yeah.
And all 1,500 people will be in the middle of a rave in the middle of my show. So it's a very modern, futuristic show. And my goal is to send people out with the thought process of that was the most insane, crazy, enjoyable show that I've ever seen. You know?
Yeah, yeah. Do you feel like, what do you feel inside you, you know, after you go away from a show, knowing that the people are literally, they could be speechless,
It's the best feeling in the world.
Yeah.
You know, I do a lot of different things. Like, as I said, I'm a mind coach. I work with a lot of business people and sports athletes on their mindset. Like, I also obviously do a lot of television shows, both here and abroad. But by far, the most enjoyable aspect of what I do is being live on stage.
Yeah.
Because I live for that feedback from an audience, the energy in a room.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's great. And we always stay down here and have a couple of drinks after the show.
Yeah,
so that's what happens. I don't really think about it too much. I'm never, ever satisfied unless I get a standing ovation. Because if I get a standing ovation, it's not for me. It's just that I know that everybody's had a good time and that I've done a good job. And that's really satisfying for me, you know.
Thanks for listening to the Glen Eagle INEC Arena podcast. If you liked this podcast, make sure you subscribe to this channel and follow us online for more.